The following podcast is a part of RadioMisfits.com.
Welcome to Misfits Making It. We're oddballs and we're doing cool stuff. I'm your host, Lauren LaGiudice. So this is the podcast version of the comedy shows I host around New York City and the road, the Misfit Variety Show, and all the shows at the Capiche Club, Misfit Comedy Space, down in Little Italy. So how's it going? What's up in your Misfit world? I've been really psyched about how people are responding to this Instagram video that I made about looking for friends in the wrong places. And it makes me feel seen and sane too, that like, I'm not crazy for seeing this. And it's this tendency that I think a lot of us might have to go look for friends in the wrong places and that complain that we're not having any friends, we're not finding any friends, no one gets us. And it's because I think like as weirdos, we often like have this like secret yearning for some sort of validation from the normies. So that's where we go like dip into that well to try to look for friends. And I learned a long time ago that is not gonna work for me. And so I've learned to go amongst people, be amongst people who share my mindset, share my curiosity, et cetera, and like find friends and community around that. But I have seen people make this mistake time and again. And I had a friend, a young friend, tell me, she's like, oh, I'm just not making any friends. I just don't feel like they get me. And I'm like, have you looked at yourself lately? You are so weird. Like, don't go to the frat party to make friends, okay? You are such a weirdo. And like, they see that about you. And you need to understand that about yourself, because that's how you're going to find community, by being around people who appreciate you for all of your like wonderful weirdness. So if you're out there and you're like, oh, man, I'm just like not happy with like the people I have around me, like, dude, you're much better than putting yourself in front of people who don't get you and don't appreciate you. You deserve a community. So go out there and do it. That's how I'm feeling. I'm feeling pepped up. I'm not alone in seeing it. And I know you're not either. So go do it. Before we get to our interview with our fellow Misfit director and novelist, Shamin Sharif, a reminder, please do rate and review the podcast, because social proof is so important for Misfits. Misfits trust other Misfits to know what's good. You can also sign up for updates at laurenlogi.com, or you could sponsor a podcast. We've made it acceptable for individuals and small businesses to sponsor us. And if we're sponsored, we will go out more often. Right now, we're every other week, we will go every week with a sponsored podcast. So go to laurenlogi.com, click on listen and podcast, and contact us there. So let's get to our interview with director and novelist Shamin Sharif. So quick caveat is that sometimes technology can fail us. And that day, the way it was recorded on the server, it led to some just like blips. So it's nothing that will prevent you from understanding what's going on or enjoying the interview. But sometimes you'll notice just like there's a gap in when we're talking, and naughty technology did that to us. So a quick note about that. Yes, we know. And sorry. Let's get to our interview with director and novelist Shamin Sharif. So I first came to know Shamin's work through Sort Of, which she directed a few episodes of. Now, Sort Of is a series that you need to watch. If you have not, shame on you. It is so good. It is like a coming of age series, but it just happens to be that the star is a gender fluid millennial South Asian person. And that's almost like besides the point. So it's so refreshing and so good. And Shamin had directed a bunch of episodes from that. So I looked into her work, and Shamin has done all of these beautiful independent films are in all of these novels which feature the queer experience, and especially with women of color. And she's able to create these highly personal stories that need to be told more often. And we get into the creative process, how she started doing what she's doing, how she continues to do it, and how to stay sane through it all. And you're going to love it. So let's get to the interview with director and novelist Shamin Sharif. Welcome.
Thank you.
To me and Sharif, to Misfits Making It.
Thank you very much. I feel good about the Misfits and the Making It. So,
Well, you've done so much cool stuff. And, you know, it's really refreshing to learn about you and your work because this podcast used to be called Reconcile the Aisle. And it was more the Trump years, people were like, a lot of people were grappling with what they're doing and their art. And is it like making a difference? And I'd ask people, like, do you feel like your art makes a difference? And not everyone felt so convinced or inspired by that. They were just like, I don't know, I just make stuff. And you believe so firmly that stories change the world. Did you always, and you said in a TEDx talk specifically, stories cut to what makes us human.
I can't.
Has that always inspired you? Is that the thing that keeps you going?
I think it's what keeps me going, but I think because it's that plus other things. But I do believe in that, and I think I should qualify that by saying I don't necessarily believe that every story I tell is going to change the entire world, but it can change the world for the person, you know, enjoying that story or listening or hearing it or watching it. So good. And I say that because it was my personal experience growing up, you know, and at that time I surely felt like a misfit because, you know, I was raised in a Muslim household, you know, knew very early on, suspected that I was queer, and it was just like very, very inconvenient. So to be able to just find stories that I felt like spoke to a little bit of the secret life that I was experiencing, on that level and on other levels, you know, wanting to be a writer or whatever it is, it, you know, didn't feel like stuff that I could talk about with my parents or my community. So I experienced the difference that having a story where characters were having the same dilemmas or overcoming them could help. And then certainly the feedback that we got from I Can't Think Straight and The World Unseen and our early films kind of really intensified that awareness for me.
Yeah. And how did you start? Like, what was your journey to making films?
So it was kind of the path to directing films really came through writing for me. So I had always started out as a writer, both of novels and screenplays at the same time, and short stories before that. But I think having a piece of work, as in a screenplay that I really, you know, that meant something to me, that was very personal to me in terms of the themes and the characters and creating them, became like a way I could petition to start directing, if you like. And with I Can't Think Straight, at the time, the person who was apparently investing in the film was going to just hire a student filmmaker because he wanted to save money. I think he didn't see the value in direction, which should have alerted us about his production skills. But I kind of pitched for the job, and so I got it. But I really didn't have the right experience or the depth of experience at that point. But I think it was certainly a wild and crazy film school where we dealt with a lot more than the usual first feature and nightmares. And on top of that, I was learning on the job, if you like. So, you know, once I got my foot in the door, I loved it. I loved working with actors. I loved finding another way to create that world and those characters that other than just in my imagination and on the page. And so I began to really, after that, try to really learn and improve the skills that you need, you know, as a director. And I think, you know, really helped. I think also direct series began to help with that as well, because you can start to practice your craft a bit more than just as an independent filmmaker when it can be several years between films, you know?
Yep. And do the novels come before the screenplays or the screenplays novels?
You know, a bit of both. For The World Unseen and Despite the Falling Snow, I wrote the novels first. I Can't Think Straight, I actually wrote the novel after the movie.
Interesting.
Which was interesting. I guess I hadn't, I had seen it first fully as a script. And so I wrote the novel after and tried not to make it a novelization. So there are some differences from the film. But generally, I will see a novel or feel a novel first. But with my new movie Polarized, which is out in Canada, but just coming out in the States probably later this year, I very much saw it just as a screenplay, as a film. So it varies.
Interesting. And how do you feel like the novel, writing a novel, feeds on the screenplay, screenplay novel? Like, what are, how does that work together?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think once you've written a novel, you really have built a whole world in your head. You know, you're forced to, for me, live what the characters are living. You know what they smell, how they taste, you know, the minute details of life that brings a page of text to life. But I think when you're then going into adapting it into a screenplay, you kind of have to be prepared to be unfaithful, to throw it out of the window, and then do that again as a director, because you don't know, you know, your locations, your actors, nothing that you envisaged in your mind as a novelist is necessarily what's going to end up on the screen. And I like to be free of that, you know. Yeah. So I've never somebody who goes, oh, I've always visualized, you know, Katya and Despite the Falling Snow looking like this. I mean, I wrote her one way in the novel, but when it came to casting Rebecca Ferguson, when I met her, it just felt like she embodied Katya, even though she didn't look as she was described in the book. So I try to remain open when I'm doing a movie and think of it as more of a collaboration, whereas as a novelist, you're kind of master of your entire world.
Yeah, it's great. And no one can, it's like you, no one can tell you, oh, we don't have that or we can't get that location. It's like, no, there it is.
There is kind of a perfection to it. But on the other hand, you don't get that collaboration of working with, you know, 100 people who are all highly skilled in very different aspects of making a film.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And what do you know, like, because you're going to have to give up some things when you're making the film. Like, what do you know, like, how do you know what to give up?
I guess when it comes down to it, it's very organic and intuitive, as in what I'll compromise on, because it really always is about character and story. And if I feel like I can tell the story without having to, you know, have a 15 crane sequence in the middle of the desert, then I'll do that. So, because I'd rather make the film than not make the film. So I've become kind of adept at trying to, at understanding how we can, you know, be creative in doing things a little more simply. With something like Polarized, you know, we had one camera, we had 17 days instead of the 25 or 30 days that we'd hoped to have for shooting. So the question was, do we want to bother making the film? Can I still make the film the way I wanted to make it? And so I was really forced to look at what the emotional content of each scene is and try to find, you know, a way to do that handheld or with fewer lights or in a smaller room or in an improvised location. And most of the time you can do that. And I think being a writer as well is really helpful so that you can just kind of imagine the way that things can be done differently. You know, and working with my partner as a producer on the films, she's always very encouraging me to have my creative vision, but also aware as a producer of the impact of certain decisions. So we try to work together. Yeah. Not to be too wild and crazy budget-wise or location-wise, but at the same time to put as much value as we can on the screen. So,
it's a balance for sure.
You get better with experience, you know, with everything. You begin to see your options a lot quicker. But it took a while, you know, to build up of confidence.
Yeah. What were some of the biggest lessons you learned during that learning process?
Oh, wow. I think the biggest congratulations I give myself is working with my partner and dragging her into the film industry as my producer, because I think it's so hard for creatives.
Wow.
Yeah. It's so hard for writers to find good producers who really will go out to bat for them nonstop, you know, because most producers have a big slate of projects, and Hanan has been very focused on One by One on our films, and it almost needs that laser focus and tenacity to get an independent film going. So I feel very, very lucky from that perspective. But I think the bigger lessons are really just really be clear about what is it you're trying to say, and not be too hung up on style over substance, because I think sometimes people can come to a sticky end when they get stuck into movies that need a lot of style. They can't see, you know, directors get stuck in a vision that they can't see any other way. And then you're shortchanging everything. Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing, by the way. You can work with your partner. I used to produce films with my ex-partner and, you know, whatever. It was fine. We just did a few short films together. But then it didn't, when things weren't working out, everything didn't work out so well.
It's full on. No. It's intense, you know?
Yeah.
It really is, because you're both consumed by, if you're in production, you're consumed by it 24/7. But we're very different people and we do very different things on the film. And we both, I think, trying to be respectful of each other's domains. And I think when you're making a movie, as when you're making a marriage generally, I think trying to maintain that respect and awareness of the other person is absolutely key. And we've always tried to make that a key, of key importance in our lives and in our relationship, because, you know, it's nuts otherwise. But I think it's so hard to have a separate life if you're in film. Like if I go out, make a movie, direct something, and she's not with me or she doesn't understand that experience. It's very intense to be a movie maker and to be on a set with 100 people who are suddenly all your best friends.
Yep.
And you're like a family for that period of time. And to have your partner not be part of that, I think is very, you know, I see it with actors, with other directors. It's tough.
Yeah.
So I feel very, very lucky that we do get to share that in a way. So I think, okay, the downside of that is, always talk about work, but then we both love our work, you know. So,
and also, if you could survive an independent film, you could survive anything.
That's true. That's true. It's like people are like, oh, we have this budget and it's never enough. I'm like, okay, well, we've done this, so we can manage.
Yeah. Right. Is it ever enough? I feel like every director I've heard in the history of the world is always like, it's never enough. And it's like, Steven Spielberg, get over yourself.
I know. It's hard to feel sorry, but they're right in a way, because your appetite always expands to your budget. And there's something very human about that. As I think, you know, if we know we have a certain amount to work with, we should be working with it. So you're always pushing the envelope of your whatever budget you have. I'm sure. I'm sure Christopher Nolan feels it too.
Yep. Absolutely. And so what has been the, well, first of all, tell us a little bit about Polarized, so people get a context. And then I'm curious what the response has been for you.
Yeah. So Polarized is a small independent movie, but we shot it out in Manitoba, and it's really a small town story, which is why we chose those beautiful prairie locations. And it's about two young women who live in the same small town, but in very different sides of it. One is the daughter of a white farming family who've recently lost their farm. Her father is sick. She has bears the brunt of making a living. And she makes a living by going to work for one of these new vertical farms, which is owned by the Palestinian immigrant family in town. And there's some resentment there on her side, this feeling that she's picked up from her community, that these guys have come in and they've taken jobs and, you know, the other farmers suffering. And so some of that bubbles up within the first few minutes of the film. And she actually gets fired by the young Palestinian woman who runs her family's first farm. But despite that, they find a way to kind of reconnect and become friends. And then that falls into a stronger relationship, more of a love story. But they're really, it's about the internal and external, I guess, things keeping them apart, and the stuff that shouldn't matter in this day and age, like race, religion, class, economics, that still keep us apart from each other. So I felt like it was kind of a relevant thing to tell in, you know, in a world where we see a big separation between the right wing and the left wing. And, you know, trying to be non-judgmental of both and see both points of view, and how it's possible, because I'm an incurable romantic and always have to have hope. Otherwise I can't get up in the morning. You know, to see how it's possible for people to get past that.
And from everything I've seen you've done, everything is very emotionally intimate. And how do you get those performances out of your actors, like again and again and again?
It's two things. I'm as careful as I can be with casting. And I think casting for me is partly about what I've seen performance wise. And with Holly DeVoe and Maxime Denny, who are the leads in Polarized, their auditions blew me away. I had not heard of them before. I was lucky that we could cast across Canada for these roles. But on top of that, it was very important to me to have a Zoom call at the time where I could talk to them, get a sense of them, how we communicate, because when you're under pressure for 17 days of shoot in, you know, difficult conditions, you know, everything is not always perfect. And, you know, sometimes I was asking these young women to knock out a big fight scene on the first day of shooting without much run up and maybe in 2-3 takes. So it was very important to me that we gelled on that level, and we did. And then the other thing I always try to build in, which I'm grateful for Hannah and my partner, that she always builds into the budget, is just to bring them a few days earlier. So I think we had nearly a week together.
Oh, that's great.
Before we started the shoot. And we really went through separately, each of us, and then together, the three of us, the entire arc of that love story and of each character. So I think because you shoot out of sequence and you shoot so fast, I think all of that really helped. But you know, above all, they were just supremely talented. Honestly, I felt very, very lucky because you never really know till you know.
Yeah.
Everybody talks a good game on a Zoom and they're all very lovely and personable. But actually, when you put them out there in front of the camera, they just knocked it out every time on the first take, I felt, more or less. And so that we were able to play by the second and third take. So it was incredible. Really wonderful experience. One of the best I've ever had.
What about their auditions? What it was about, like specifically about their auditions?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think both of them found, you know, I remember with Maxine's audition for Dahlia, she really played the spaces between the dialogue so that it, you know, it told me that she was understanding the subtext, because the dialogue was not about what was being said in the scene. It was about what was felt. And she got that on her audition. And the same for Holly. She got that too, but she also found, you know, Lisa, the girl who's fired and is then offered her job back. She's got this kind of injured pride that she will not just accept a handout or anything she perceives that way. So, and she got all of that again, even though it wasn't in the text. And she put all of that into the audition, and it was a really a standout choice really, I felt she got to the core of Lisa.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's like why they can't replace us with robots, or I hope they can't, or they don't try to.
Honestly, you know, maybe one day they'll get an AI who's that sophisticated. But, you know, I think the joy of this job for me is working with humans and all of us, you know, working together and being able to really excavate character and emotion and whatever. And it's beautiful. I feel very, very privileged to be able to
do that. And like, you know, seeing what happened in the room, because you don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's going to happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's all informed by what kind of a day you had. And did you have a fight with your partner the day before, maybe? Or, you know, are you feeling insecure at this moment as an actor? You know, all of these things play in, and how we all have to read each other and understand each other. And, you know, they maybe get the sense that I'm under pressure and have to do this in one long take or something. You know, it's just, but we're all kind of working together in beautiful symbiosis in the best possible way. And this was one of those.
And your work is span genres, because you do have thrillers and then you have more intimate. So how, like, what has inspired that? Like, what, how did that happen? Basically, how did it happen? Why is it like this?
I don't know. You know what? I'm kind of genre agnostic, I think I realized, because I really enjoy. I enjoy thrillers. I enjoy action. I enjoy rom-coms. And I enjoy writing in all of those genres as well. I'm not that keen on horror. Actually, I'm not keen on horror at all. I mean, I like things
I can't watch it. I get scared.
Yeah. You know, there's a Jordan Peele movie, which has a real kind of underlying meaning. And it's not, I love that, but it's not going to be my first genre. But other than that, it's just like, why not? You know? And I think but really my key thing is I always wanted to write roles for women. Often queer women, often women of color. And I think the genre became almost secondary to that. And so something like Despite the Falling Snow, where it's, you know, there's a spy thriller element to the love story between Katya and Alexander. It was just interesting to me to push that theme of betrayal and honesty in a relationship by, you know, making the stakes life and death. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens when you're a spy and you're spying on a government minister and you fall in love with that person? So, you know, it's just a higher stakes way to explore another relationship.
Mm-hmm. And do you, when you write in a different genre that you haven't written before, do you do like a deep dive on that genre before you read, or you just do from what you feel, or how do you operate that?
I think it's pretty much from what I feel. It's not like when I wrote Despite the Falling Snow, it wasn't like I'd never written a thriller or an action you know, thing, or the same with the Athena Protocol, which is a very different genre for me. I mean, at least I can say with my early novels, Despite the Falling Snow and The World Unseen, they were literary fiction in one kind or another. But with the Athena Protocol and the Shadow Mission, they were completely spy thriller genre. So I did do more research on that. And in terms of, you know, where the twists ideally come, what is it that causes that? But I also I wanted it to be very emotionally based. So, you know, I looked for a story and for a thriller reversals, which could be connected to character flaws. So, you know, somebody goes down the wrong path, not because of a random MacGuffin, but kind of they emotionally got connected to the wrong person or trusted the wrong person.
Yeah.
So kind of that emotional connection to the twists, plot twists, is very important to me, even when writing a thriller. So I knew that was something that I wanted for sure. But I try not to read too much in that genre while I'm writing, because I don't want to start imitating anybody's style.
Yes. Yeah. 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 I've heard some people say like they try not to watch stuff sometimes because you're just like, oh, I'm going to be pulled a little too much.
Yeah. I'm a terrible one for imitating accents. So I don't think I do it with writing, but, you know, just as well not to.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then what has been the response to Polarized?
Oh, my God. Really great, which is so nice. So our first proper release has only been in Canada with other territories to follow. So, but all the newspaper and online reviews were fantastic. And I think the overriding thing I took from those were the performances were really wonderful, which is great. But that people were ready for the story to be told, because I think people are feeling it post-Trump, post-Brexit, you know, all of that division that's been sown by politicians in this sort of semi-rise of fascism that we have in some parts of the world. And I think people were ready for a story that was a little bit hopeful and that addressed those issues. And Polarized is set in Canada. It's equally relevant, I think, to anywhere in North America. But, you know, in Canada, those are issues that are not always discussed, because Canada is often so much more welcoming to immigrants than America traditionally is perceived as being. But there are still, you know, those issues, and you know, and for the existing families like Lisa's family, I wanted it to be understandable that there's this feeling of scarcity and suspicion, you know, that you can also understand. It's not, maybe not right, but you can understand it. And so it takes some wearing away for her to get rid of that. But when she does, she's also able to open up and think of the world as being a bigger place.
Yeah. And is there, I mean, your movies feature a lot of LGBTQ characters, women of color. Like, has there been backlash against it just in this terrible world? That wasn't all terrible, but there's so many terrible people out there. And you have stuff online, you know, like, what have you experienced? Any poo-poo faces?
I'm going to say really very little, and nothing that I would even be bothered to dwell on. I think I feel very lucky that from the beginning, I really went on social media about 15 years ago when I Can't Think Straight in the World Unseen came out, because I was so deluged with email. And so I thought, okay, let me just kind of interact with people on Facebook and Instagram or whatever. Well, Instagram wasn't around back then, and Twitter. And it was amazing that it felt like much more like a deluge of people saying, thank you for giving us this representation, or I live over here, or I'm Middle Eastern, or I'm Pakistani. And it never occurred to me that it was possible. Now I can see that it's possible. I still don't know how I'm going to do it, but, you know, whatever. But, and it's really interesting, the story. So I think there's been a lot more positive stories out of India. We've had fans who've set up, you know, escaped arranged marriages and set up groups for other LGBTQ women in India. That was particularly amongst the Dalit community, who are the untouchables, who have, you know, even worse, because they're not within, usually not within the more liberal cities in India. So it's harder out in the villages. So, you know, it's been overwhelmingly good. And I just kind of choose to try to focus there, because I feel by interacting too much with people who are just homophobic or racist, I don't feel like I'm going to change those minds by hitting back at them on Twitter, and I really feel it, it doesn't do wonders for my mental health, and it takes away creative energy that I'd rather put out another piece of work like Polarized into the world and just make my statement that way as much as possible.
Yeah. It's interesting. I also had, because I impersonated Melania Trump for a few years. I was doing comedy as her and stand up. And people, I make all these videos and people would say to me, like, you must get so much hate. And I'm like, you know, I think sometimes the algorithm works in your favor because they, not going to, if they can tell someone's going to be like not a fan, they're not going to show it to them. And often, and then often if you just block immediately or ignore, like they don't come after you. It's funny, the most amount of hate I've gotten, I have this Gen X mom character. And like, I made the mistake of hitting back at someone who like hated on her. I'm like, she's just like a crazy lady, you know, just like being wild. And like, I got hate and I made the mistake of pinging back. Right. And then it brought them.
Oh, they all came.
Whoever they are, the robots. Because I don't even know if it's a person. Who knows who these people are?
Yeah.
It's like, you know.
No. It's interesting. I'm sorry you had to go through that, but it is interesting. And I think you're right. And I think part of my more sanguine view now is because, you know, when Hanan and I were coming out, 27 years have been together, and we're Middle Eastern family, Indian Muslim family, nobody was happy. And then we had kids, like triple, like, what do we tell people? Our daughters don't have men. And then it was a drama. People were disowning us left, right, and center. People were freaking out. And we engaged, of course, there are families, you know, and you feel hard done by, and we were like telling all our friends, and it felt like this continuous cycle of misery, and I'm sure our friends felt the same. We're like, oh my God. And I think at a point we were just like, to hell with this, you know, let's just focus on building our own family. If they want to come along, they can come. And I guess I think as soon as you shift your focus, the power on you that they have decreases. And I feel like having gone through that, I don't want to be again, because I have people who say, you know, I had this on Twitter and somebody said this and then I said that. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to get into that, because we can all be righteous. And of course, you know, people are hating on you for impersonating Melania Trump or pretty, you know, they have too much time in their hands. Let's say that people who are coming after me for being, you know, whatever, Muslim and gay or whatever it might be, I don't care. And you know what? It's like, I get it. It's your, you know, it's how you feel.
Yeah.
It's not relevant to me. And it's not, I don't think it's relevant to the future. And so have at it, but I'm not going to waste my time and energy engaging anymore. Unless, you know, there's something which I feel needs to be addressed. Will I post something about Roe versus Wade being overturned? You bet. But overall, I'm not going to like engage on a minute level if I don't have to.
Yeah, totally. Sometimes I'm like, they might be robots. And a lot of times I'm like, these are bot accounts. So like I am interacting with a right-wing robot.
Yeah.
And I'm feeding into, they want to like sort of sow division, whatever it is. Or even if, I don't even know what's right wing. It might be a Russian bot farm. Who knows? I don't know. Who knows?
You really don't know. And it's just, it becomes pernicious. And I think it's about valuing your time as a human, you know. And as I get older and I just think, well, you know, every moment is important, right? And precious. And already it's bad enough that you forget that half a dozen times during the day and you get snitty or tired or. It's just like, no, I'd rather, you know, I could read for that half an hour.
So you've worked in episodic. Do you think you'd ever like could leave episodic? Leave indie film for episodic, or how do you feel?
I love
the allure of television.
I love indie film, but the reality is, you know, it takes forever to make an indie film. So, you know, what are you going to do in those 3-4 years, right? So I'm happy to be able to have this combination of the two where I can go off and do episodic. But what I'd rather do ultimately as well is develop my own shows. So that's something that I'm actively doing now with Hanan. And we have a slate of series projects that we're working on developing, writing pilots for, pitching. So, you know, hopefully something, one or two of those come to fruition over the next year or two, and we can have the best of both worlds.
Super cool. Do you feel like if it doesn't come to fruition, you'll just like make an indie movie about it, or like make it into a film and
Maybe.
Fuck him.
Maybe. And listen, we both love film, so I think we'll always have a couple of film projects on the go, which we do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've got a new rom-com called Arrange that I've written, which is a cultural romantic comedy set in the South Asian community about two young women who are pushed into an arranged marriage by their moms. But they don't get along, so they just pretend to be dating each other. Until they actually fall in love. So, you know, I've got a couple of projects on the go like that. So, you know, if one of those comes out, that's great. We'll go off and make it. But I think the days of waiting around for something to get off the ground it's a very capricious industry, and it's getting harder.
Yeah.
For film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so what is your, we call it your misfit turning moment when you were like, traditional world is not for me. Did you have a moment? And you're like, onward.
Oh, gosh, yes. I have many of them, I think. I think one big one is realizing that I was not going to be marrying one of the suitable boys that my family were hoping I was going to be marrying. Another one, but I still kept that kind of under my hat because I was such an introvert that I wasn't kind of like hanging out in gay bars or anything like that. I couldn't fathom how I would meet anybody, but I knew I wasn't going to like end up down that path, right? And then something very ironic.
And you were in London when you came out in London?
Yeah, I did.
There's so many fun gay bars in London.
I know. Honestly, I was like somebody raised by wolves. I was very, very painfully shy and introverted. But I pushed myself to go on this date with this really nice guy who was from my community, kind of a last ditch effort by my grandmother to set me up. And we go out. He said, I'll take you to dinner in town in Mayfair or whatever, and we'll just stop by and have drinks with my friend Hanan first. You're really going to love her. And we sat there and we had drinks, and she was late. And she came in wearing a Looney Tunes t-shirt and her hair all over the place and gave him a very hard time. And I thought, oh, wow, she's so cool. And anyway, cut to a few years later, we ended up together. So he did introduce me to, you know, my wife, the love of my life. So in a weird way, those two kind of moments melded. And I guess another one was really thinking about becoming a writer. And I knew that I couldn't think of anything else that I wanted to do. So I studied English literature, and then I came back and knew I wanted to write. And then just like got busy. I had a job, but I got busy working evenings and weekends, just trying to make that happen. Yeah. So I guess I always had that kind of tenacity to keep going, even though I didn't know if anybody was going to publish anything that I did, and I didn't know anybody in the film industry, so I had no idea how to get started, but I knew I had to give
that's
it
amazing.
A go.
So you just were like, all right, I'm just going to write in the evenings, write on the weekends, and that's how it's going to go.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's important for people to hear, because people are like, I don't know how to do it. It's like, no one on this podcast has ever like gotten permission. No one's like gotten granted the like fairy godmother of misfits. Like, now you can write.
Right.
So, you know, they just do it.
That's so weird.
You just got to do it. You know,
it is, because exactly. There's no other way. And so I think a lot of people have the feeling that it might be nice to write, but I think if you're impelled and you can't not do it, it's the only way.
Yeah, absolutely. And what are some, you know, we all have our ups and downs. What is some, like we call a misfit inspiration that you have, either like a quote, a movie, a book, anything that helps you go on, keeps you going?
That's a really good question. I think it's my wife, honestly.
She's an angel. She produces your films and keeps you going. Angel.
She does. She's not always polite about it. She'll be like, I've forgotten how to write. And she'll be like, no, you haven't. Get back out there and give me 5 pages, you know. But it's great to have somebody who can kind of, you can talk to about that stuff. Otherwise, I think it's retreating into maybe a Spotify playlist or a familiar book, you know, maybe something that's going to make me just feel better by the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. that kind
of
thing.
It's going to be okay.
Watching Moonstruck or something.
Happy. Moonstruck. Okay, cool. Cool. Moonstruck. Cool. The Italian accents. I mean, I'm thinking of the right movie, right? Cher?
Yeah.
They sound like Cher, girl. I'm Italian. Well, that's what we're going to actually bring on next. So I am going to give you a question as a character, as one of my characters. So I grew up Italian-American. Yep. Turns out I'm 50% English because my parents is a sperm donor. Whole thing. But
and you didn't know?
I didn't know.
Oh,
I didn't know. But I still got that Italian imprinting. And So I have a lot of characters who are Italian. So you're going to meet Dad. He's a boomer from Brooklyn, Bensonhurst, New York. So he's himself. Okay. So hello, how's it going? It's nice to meet someone outside of Bensonhurst in Staten Island. Okay, listen, here's the thing. I'm telling my daughter all the time, assholes, this is my problem with the world. There's too many fucking morons. And the thing is, here's the thing. There's assholes. And then they go make other assholes. And then before you know it, the whole world is full of assholes. And my daughter's telling me this is not a good way to think. It makes you angry, blah, 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 blah. But the thing is, I'm at the red light behind someone and it turns green. And they're fucking sitting there with their fucking phone on their phone going on Instagram or whatever, Facebook or whatever the fuck they do. And they don't give a fuck about no one. So how am I to believe in humanity when people act like such assholes?
Dad. You know what? If you'd asked me 5 years ago, I'd be like, yeah, whatever. Absolutely. Drives me nuts. But now I just kind of like try to move on. Move on, leave him be.
So but what do? You're stuck behind the moron. She's sitting there with her phone. You see her take a selfie and you have to find somewhere to fucking go.
You know what? Some days you use the horn. Some days you just switch on the radio and listen to something good.
Yeah, my daughter's trying to get me to listen to podcasts. I'm listening, you know, I listen to my news and all the thing, the traffic report, but gets me more aggravated. I got to listen to a podcast or something. Okay, all right.
Podcasts are good. Music's good. I would stay clear of the news. I'm sorry to say I've started to stay clear of the news a lot. I read the New York Times, but backwards. So I never get time to finish it. So I never make it to the worst of it. Of course I glance at what's going on, but it's just, I feel very, you end up just getting anxiety.
Well, I kind of live in a state of anger and anxiety. It makes me comfortable. I'm from New York, but that's good. You read it backwards and you watch the sports, which is the one thing you got to know. Met fan, just know you're not from New York. A lesson, the Yankees, go fuck the Yankees. Mets is where it's at. Queens, that's it. The underdogs forever. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your advice. I'm going to try podcasts. We'll see if this works.
You know what? I hear that Misfits Making It is a good podcast.
Yeah, my daughter did that thing. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Whatever. She's weird. It's okay. All right. I like classic film. I'll listen to something there. I like Cary Grant, all those other people. Perfect. Maybe something like that. Okay. All right. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So thanks for hanging out with Dad. That's how I deal with my, sometimes when I'm in a misfit moment, I ask my characters, like my one character in particular. I'm like, Kamara, Carmela, what should I do? She's like, don't worry about it. You get to do it. Who cares?
I love that. I love that. Do you ever ask Melania Trump?
No. I'm afraid what she's going to say, like, oh, whatever. Just take the money and run. You know, she's so.
That's true.
She'd be like, what? Integrity? I don't understand.
Well, at least you can ask whoever's answer you want. You kind of know now, don't you?
That's true. Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, you call the friend you want to, like, they're going to tell you what you want to hear. Right.
You can choose. Yeah, I love it.
That's super fun. Well, tell us where we can come follow you, see what's next.
Well, at Shamim Sarif is pretty much my handle on everything. So you come hang with me, especially on Instagram and Facebook these days, I guess, you'll find out more. And at Polarized_movie for more about Polarized and when it's releasing and wherever you are.
Super fun. Well, we look forward to seeing it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
Well, there you have it. You can follow the podcast on my page at Lauren Logi. Updates and inside info on my email list, LaurenLogi.com. Thank you to Annie McCutcheon for editing, Edward Silla at Radio Misfits Podcast Network, and Maddie McLennan for making the podcast art. Thanks to our listeners for bringing us back for another season. We'll see you soon.
The proceeding was a presentation of the Radio Misfits Podcast Network. Find our other great shows on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at RadioMisfits.com.